Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Edward Curtin joins me today. Edward teaches sociology at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He is educated in the classics, philosophy, literature, theology, and sociology. He is a writer who focuses on varied topics and has been published widely over the years. He writes as a public intellectual for the general public and not as a specialist for a narrow readership. He believes a non-committal sociology is an impossibility, and therefore he sees all of his work as an effort to enhance human freedom through understanding. And I absolutely agree with that. And one of his most recent pieces, which will form the basis of our conversation today, titled At the Lost and Found, which he originally published at his website, edwardcurtin.com, and which was republished at offguardian.org shortly thereafter, is a case study in a piece of writing that is meant to enhance human freedom through understanding. It's a terrific lyrical essay, a wonderful existential meditation on where we are right now, what has brought us to this point, especially with regard to digital technology, what digital technology has done to us and what it is doing to us as we speak. So without further ado, Edward, welcome to Perspective. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I'm very happy to be here.
Great. So I want to start with the epigraph to your piece, which is taken from Samuel Beckett's novel, Malone Dies, which was published a long time ago, relatively speaking, in 1951. And the epigraph reads, "Nothing is more real than nothing." And I first want to say that Beckett is one of my favorite writers. And I find that line can be interpreted in so many ways. But what really jumps out at me is I wonder if Beckett were still alive, if he were with us right now, what he would think of where humanity is at. And I wonder what your hypothesis of that would be.
Well, first, just let me add, I did retire from teaching a few years ago, Jesse, so I'm no longer teaching.
Okay.
Back to Beckett. I think he would be even more in despair at the human condition and at the social condition of the world than he was back in the early 1950s. And he was, of course, he wrote about the despair, which was his, if not his solution, it was his means of keeping going and keeping alive. And I think he'd be deeply depressed today by the situation with propaganda, which is never ending, and the digital revolution, which has just enhanced the propaganda effects enormously, and in the hands of those who really control the internet, which are the intelligence services and the big media companies who are their handmaidens. So I think he would think that much of what passes for reality is really nothing in multiple senses, and that people are living in a condition of despair, not even knowing they're in despair.
Yes, I would have to agree with you there. And you hit on something that seems to be at the heart of this essay, and that is not just despair, but despair that is acute and ubiquitous, but largely unrealized by most of us who are experiencing it, because we are incessantly distracted by the digital world, whether it's on our phones, whether it's on our laptops, or whether we're watching Netflix on our flat screen TVs. And it's so powerful, not just the despair, but the distraction. It's so distracting that I would argue it makes us feel that every time we engage in it, we're actually engaging with something of substance. It's almost as if the distraction is so powerful, it does a 180, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. It's nothing in a sense, and yet it's everything in another sense. And people are truly addicted to it. It's not that the internet does not provide many good and informative programs like yours and websites that are really are wonderful. I mean, there are many wonderful sites, but most people don't go to those places. It's mm-hmm. a small minority that does. And the addiction to the social media, to the phone, is, I don't think it's an accident. This may sound a little odd, but I don't think it's an accident that the rise of the internet and digital technology and the vast increase in propaganda on every single issue have gone hand in hand. In that article, I quote Marshall McLuhan, a great supposed great writer from the 1960s and 70s, who predicted the rise of this electronic media. And I believe encouraged it, although others say no, and that's a debate for another day. But I think that when the computer revolution took place, those in power knew where it would go and what they could do with it, and mm-hmm. that is no accident. So the obsession with the internet, with the phone, with the digital technology, with social media, is I think part of an effort not only to distract but to dumb down people and to overwhelm them with so much information that they can't make heads nor tails of it. Back in 1960 or 59, there was a sociologist named C. Wright Mills who wrote a famous book. He was a wonderful thinker. He wrote a book called The Sociological Imagination. And in the beginning of that book, he says everyone needs to develop this sociological imagination, which allows you to see things in a much larger perspective, to see the personal embedded in the social overwhelming the personal, to see personal problems being part of social issues and so forth. But he said most people today, this is 1960 approximately, are overwhelmed with too much information, and they can't make lucid summaries of really what's going on. And that was 62 years ago. And today it's over the top. It's insane.
Yes, it absolutely is insane. And I'm 39, so I was born in 83. And for much of my life, up until I was about 18, there were no cell phones, or they weren't everywhere as they are now. There certainly weren't smartphones. And the internet was more of a luxury than anything else. It was a resource, but it was almost like having a television when televisions first came out. Not everybody had a desktop with an internet hookup. And very quickly, that changed. So since then, I've lived in this increasing what's become digital insanity. But I still very vividly remember and long for every day that time of my life when this technology, the technology we have now, wasn't available and certainly wasn't as out of control or unquantifiable as it is now. Almost as if my life has been split between analog and digital, if that makes sense. And I don't see, I try to conceive of a way. I realize I can't go back fully to the analog period, but I try to conceive of ways to balance the two, but it's very difficult. And I've just, based on the nature of the work I do, I have to spend a lot of time online, but it feels like handcuffs a lot of the times, despite the utility of the internet and despite the necessity of it for the sort of work I do.
Yes, I feel the same way. When I sent you the information for this interview, it asked for my cell phone number, and I kind of chuckled because I don't have a cell phone. But obviously, I use the internet. But by not having a cell phone, at least I have created let's say, analog light in my life. So when I'm walking around or going any place, I'm not constantly in touch. Mm-hmm. And it's very important for me to be out of touch, lost in the woods, so to speak, where I can breathe the air and think my own thoughts rather than constantly having people telling me what to think via the smartphone. And I think that the powers that be know that those phones in particular, much more so than the internet proper, are key to their efforts to control us, because they go with people everywhere and they follow people. So I agree with you. I mean, I'm obviously much older than you. And so I lived at a time when, you know, there was just a house phone. And a lot of people say that when you write about this stuff, meaning me, that I'm being nostalgic. Well, you could put it that way if you want and give that sense of nostalgia a bad name. But I think I'm talking about something that most people today, most people, even those addicted to the phone, know in their hearts there's something wrong. And yet they don't know how to break the cycle because it's very hard to do it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I experience that myself on a daily basis, and I see others caught in the throes of that on a daily basis. You have a great line in this essay. They carry cell phones as sidearms to defend themselves from reality. And you're referring, in this case, the they, you're referring to members of the generation of the 1960s, how would you say it, the baby boomers.
Yeah.
You're referring to them now as not only the people who carry these cell phones as sidearms to defend themselves from reality, but also the people who did a lot of the work to create the computer revolution and then the subsequent digital revolution, but who once stood in many senses opposed to such technological advancement, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. In the 1960s, the baby boomer generation, and even those that kind of spilled over into the early 70s, they were opposed to technology. The IBM computer, which had these papers, cards that got punched, was the arch enemy. And they wanted to simplify life, and they were against war, and they were against the oppression of corporations like IBM and the coming computer revolution. And then they went on, and as they got older, they softened up, and they became, quote, normal, accepted. I'm not saying everyone, not everyone, just the vast majority of that generation. And then in the 70s, the people who created the computer revolution, like Bill Gates and those guys, they were all of a certain age in the 70s. They weren't exactly baby boomers, but I guess they technically were. Yeah, they would be baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of ironic twist that the same people who were against it now are for it. But that's also consonant with this whole movement of liberals who have become like Joseph McCarthy adherents today, who support censorship, who love the CIA, who admire people like Joseph Biden and Barack Obama, who wage wars, and who are Biden pushing us towards a nuclear confrontation. Mm-hmm. And they admire these people, and it's like the 1950s have switched places. It was the so-called conservatives, the Joseph McCarthyites, the John Birches, and now it's this whole liberal generation who has flipped the coin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's so true. And that's something I started to see. Well, certainly after Trump was elected in 2016, I started to see this sea change, this reversal, and political alliances or affiliations, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Recalibrating in very interesting ways to get us to the point where we are now. And I wonder how much of that was calculated and how much of it has been organic. But more importantly, I wonder how much the liberals veering heavily into conservatism a la Joseph McCarthy, those liberals nowadays, I wonder how much of their words and their actions, their worldviews, how much of that is driven by what you home in on in this essay, which is a need to protect oneself from nothingness, the nothingness of oblivion, I suppose you could call it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Jesse. I think a huge part of it is connected to that. And that would be also connected to the change in religious and spiritual sensibility from not just the 1960s, but if we looked at the 1960s to now, in the 1960s, there was this quest for spiritual illumination, for meaning in life. Among that generation, it was a big part of that. And it was also a rejection of traditional religion across the board, really. And it was a radical disruption that took place. And gradually, many of that generation drifted away from the traditional religions. They sought insight into which it was good, into Eastern religions and world religions. But then I think the whole consumer reality also was working on them at the same time, which reduced people to almost consuming machines. The whole capitalist rhetoric. And behind that was this sense of nothingness, this sense of that nothing really matters. There is no truth. There is no ultimate reality. There is no sustenance to bear us up in a spiritual sense. It's all a
lot of postmodernism.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, mm-hmm. For sure. And so that kicks in over the decades, the whole postmodern perspective, that there are many, many perspectives, but there's no truth whatsoever, which is a huge part of the last 40 years, especially 30 years. Yeah, postmodernism.
So yes,
Yeah, go on.
Go ahead, please.
No, I don't know what I was going to say.
Okay, no worries. That happens to me very often. So with postmodernism, that's obviously I hesitate to call it a philosophy because it's hollow when you really get down to it. There's nothing there. There's no richness to make it deserving of being called a philosophy. But for the sake of this conversation, maybe let's call it a pseudo-philosophy. That pseudo-philosophy has been around for quite some time, decades. Okay. Arguably, we can go back to McLuhan writing in the 60s and perhaps find its origins there. But it's gotten to the point now where this idea of there is no truth, I have my truth, you have yours, has led to some very problematic developments in society as a whole. So one that strikes me is the so-called trans movement. And I'm not talking about adults who choose to pursue that path. I'm talking about how this has been turned on children specifically, and children who are still developing, who still have barely a conception of the world and how it works, are being groomed to think that there's no such thing as a man and a woman. That's not a truth. That's not a biological truth. You can be whatever you want. If you want to identify as a dog, you can do so. And then you can demand that people refer to you as a dog. Or if we're keeping it in the human species, by whichever pronouns. And again, I don't have a problem if an adult of their own volition chooses to do that. But when it comes to children, and then that leads to the mutilation of their biology through hormone disruption, for example, by medicines, or medicines in inverted commas, and then of course the sex change surgeries, which are irreversible. That, for as one example, is to me a dangerous society-wide development that can be traced directly back to the postmodern ideology, I think is a better term for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. For adults can make their choices, and I respect their choices. And that's, you know, those are their lives. But children are a different ball game. And I think that has really hurt kids and confused them. But I see it all as part of it sounds like, I almost used the word a vast conspiracy, but to confuse and confound people, to shake them up so they don't know whether they're coming or going on any issue whatsoever, unless the authorities want them to move in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. If you go, I remember thinking a couple of weeks ago about a lot of this stuff, and there's a couple of phrases that I'm sure your listeners have heard, and you have heard, and I have heard. One is that people say everything is relative.
Mm-hmm.
But that phrase means, really, everything is relative, but not this, what I'm telling you, that everything is relative. This is the truth, that everything is relative.
Right.
It's a tricky statement. But why would you believe the statement everything is relative if it wasn't the truth?
Right.
And then there's another way of putting it. People say, you know, there is no truth, which means accept what I'm telling you, that there is no truth. That's the truth.
Yes, that's always struck me whenever I've heard any of those utterances. The vehemence with which they'll be uttered, as well, as if, well, yes, there is no truth, but what I'm telling you is true, as you just said. It's there's something very psychological at work there that I don't quite know how to pinpoint, but it's not good, and it's only become more pervasive as not just time has gone by, but as digital technology and what I call the digital panopticon has been built out. And it's, as you said, it's gotten to a point where not only are we dealing with a deluge of information on a second by second basis, but it's a deluge that you can't make sense of, and that obliterates any way of getting at the truth of any given development that's happening in the world. And it's maddening. And as I said, I experience it on a daily basis with the work I do, reading media and trying to even understand, why is this a story? Why is this a thing right now? Any given story? Why is this being told to me, whether it's through corporate media or independent media? So you start to get into these levels of interaction that I think we need to engage with, but the rate at which the information comes, which you also discuss in your essay, is, I agree with you. I think it's calibrated or calculated to drive us mad in a sense and drive us into despair and to paralyze us. And it's been quite effective at doing so, I would say. We need to take a quick pause, but when we come back, I want to pick up on that and certainly a number of other things you touch on in this wonderful essay. So everybody hang tight, and I'll be right back with Edward Curtin here on TNT Radio after this.
You should hear what Brian McClain is talking about.
Texas authorities have opened a criminal investigation into Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's shipment of nearly 50 migrants from Texas to Florida to Martha's Vineyard last week. The Bexar County Sheriff's Office is probing whether the migrants, primarily from Venezuela, were victims of crimes. Sheriff Salazar said the immigrants were, quote, lured to board flights from San Antonio in Bexar County with false promises of employment and opportunity, when in reality, he said, they were used as political pawns. Well, political posturing. All of a sudden, people are upset about political posturing, huh? That is extremely disingenuous, considering the amount of political posturing and people being used as pawns for political posturing. So more political posturing to make sure that we're all mad about political posturing.
Brian McClain on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Did you know that hepatitis C causes tens of thousands of U.S. deaths every year? Hepatitis C is the leading cause of cirrhosis and liver cancer, and the leading cause of death from liver disease. Those who have hepatitis C often don't even know it. But there is good news. Not only good, but easy. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. If you do have it, it's curable. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. In fact, one little blood test and you can do your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested, get treated, get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
It's never a burden to fight for truth. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zerwell, and I'm speaking with Edward Curtin, who is a sociologist and a writer, and the author, I neglected to mention in my introduction, of an excellent book, Seeking Truth in a Country of Lies, Critical and Lyrical Essays, which was published by Clarity Press in 2020 and has received acclaim. The book speaks for itself, trust me, but it's received acclaim from several people I quite admire, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Mark Crispin Miller, for example. Well worth your time. And if I may say so, get the hard copy instead of the digital version, if you can. It's a much more rewarding experience. So that said, Edward, I want to read a quote you have in the piece we've been using as the basis for our conversation at The Lost and Found, which you published in early August on your website, edwardcurtin.com. And the quote reads as such: electromagnetic technology requires utter human docility and quiescence of meditation, such as befits an organism that now wears its brain outside its skull and its nerves outside its hide. Man must serve his electronic technology with the same servo-mechanistic fidelity with which he served his coracle, his canoe, his typography, and all other extensions of his physical organs. But there is this difference, that previous technologies were partial and fragmentary, and the electric is total and inclusive. An external consensus or conscience is now as necessary as private consciousness. So people might be surprised to find out that Marshall McLuhan wrote that in the 1960s. And I'm homing in on this in particular because it reads as something that Yuval Noah Harari or Klaus Schwab could say at this very moment in time. The parallels not only of the language, but of the philosophy and the view of humanity and human beings is, it's quite staggering to me.
Yes, it's especially that last sentence about you need to have an external conscience and consciousness to tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. As if the human being has disappeared into the machine, which is exactly what people like Klaus Schwab and others hope is the future. And this is, I think, the great danger, that people will continue to buy into the technology, which will lead them into a place that I don't even know how to describe it, but it's hell. It's total control. But McLuhan, it sure sounds to me like he was in his book, he was saying, this is good stuff, folks. It's coming, and you have to accept it. You have to. You have no choice. And again, that goes back to choice. You don't have any choice. It's a deterministic philosophy, which again plays through all of the things that we've been talking about. The concept of human freedom, as the existentialist used the sense, no longer exists. Everyone is determined. They're determined by their biology, and McLuhan says we're determined by the electronic media, and you're determined by your environment, and so on and so forth. What can you do? You have to give up. You have to live in despair. Just accept it. And this goes back to where we started our conversation, this feeling of hopelessness. If there's nothing you could do about anything, then you're screwed. We're all screwed. But I think there is something that we can do. Believe in freedom first. Mm-hmm. You begin with that and then say, hey, what can I do? And the more people ask that question and answer it in the affirmative and come together in some kind of large groupings and say, no, we're free. We're not machines. And I go back to what you said. I think you said something very astute. You compared you were talking about analog technology and digital technology. And the digital technology, this is a very subtle thing, I think, today. I don't even know if it's subtle for people. But analog technology is based on the rhythms of the planets and nature and the turning of the seasons and our bodies and our connection to the earth and to each other. Digital mm-hmm. technology is connected to numbers, clicking numbers. And a whole way of thinking, a new way of thinking, which has nothing to do with meaning at all. It just has to do with numbers. And there are these digital clocks. They click, they click, they click, and the numbers click. And, you know, it's like, let's start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4. So I think you were onto something very important when you said that.
Yes, and there are so many ways we can go here. I'm struggling to pick a path, but that's a good thing because
yes,
it's a very expansive conversation that I think we need to have on individual levels like we are having and on community levels as well. But one thing I want to point out is what you hit on with regard to the deterministic nature of this philosophy, because that is exactly how the fourth industrial revolution, touted by Klaus Schwab and Yuval Noah Harari, the World Economic Forum, which I by no means see as the top of this, what I call the globalist predator class hierarchy. I think they are more so of a PR firm than anything else. But they do have power and they do have influence. There's no doubt about that. But when you listen to Klaus Schwab speak and Yuval Noah Harari speak, these two individuals in particular, they constantly tell us that this so-called fourth industrial revolution is inevitable because this is where technology is going. It has to be this way. And there's no second choice, let alone third choice. And when you take a step back from that and remove yourself from the fear and anxiety that I believe that is meant to induce in us, you see that they're just saying that it has to be that way. It is not written stone anywhere that this is the way the future of humanity has to go or is definitely going. That's something they are trying to project and impose upon us. And they've done a very good job, but it's not our fate. It's not sealed that that's going to be how humanity ends up. So I wanted to point that out. And if you have any thoughts on that, please feel free to share them.
Sure. I agree that they're just saying that and trying to impose that on the world. But it is far from inevitable. And across the globe, there are a lot of people in a lot of countries who sense that this is radically wrong and it's not the future that we want. And of course, it's I don't know if it's a minority of people or a majority of people. But the problem is that too many people are buying into this. I mean, wherever you go, people have cell phones and they don't think for one minute the implications of having these phones. I do harp on the cell phone in particular. Perhaps soon you don't need a cell phone. You'll have a wristband or something implanted in your hand that you can use instead of the phone. They'd like that. But as of now, it's the cell phone in particular that I think is the key to all of this. But I don't know how to disabuse people of their addiction to these phones. I just don't know.
I think one possibility is setting an example, an individual example, through your own practice, not foisting it on anybody, but just living as you do, such as in your case, you don't have a smartphone or a cell phone, period. And I find that commendable. The only other person in my life whom I know who doesn't have a cell phone, who's never had a cell phone, let alone a smartphone, is my father. And he's 75 and he has staunchly refused to ever acquire one of these devices. And I admire that. He uses the internet, but he's not addicted to the internet. He's not on there 24/7. He's not a Luddite, but I think he's been very wise in staying away from the cell phones and then the smartphones, because if you think about those, you can carry smartphones everywhere. your whole life starts to become compartmentalized into the smartphone, especially as the storage capacity and the speed of these devices increase. And that allows for all sorts of tracking and monitoring, and also the consolidation of, let's say, necessary documentation. So, for example, your passport or your vaccination record. And we know where this leads to. This leads to even more control than we see right now. And, you know, I mentioned the hierarchy earlier of the global, the globalist predator class. At the top of that hierarchy, I see the international banking cartel, the central bankers, and I don't think they're really wasting time playing around with any of this technology. They're content to see us distracted by it on a daily basis, a second by second basis. And that's fine for them while they make their moves restructuring the international monetary and financial system by whatever way, by whatever means necessary, whether that's through staging a pandemic, as we've seen with COVID-19, or I believe carrying out a war such as the one we're seeing in Ukraine right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you, just to go back to the beginning of this long point I'm trying to make, that the phones are a huge problem because, as you've said, they've become appendages. They've become sidearms, and everywhere I look, somebody is looking at their phone stooped over in that all too familiar position. And it's like the most catastrophic thing could happen in front of them, and they'll barely look up. But also the information control that allows the powers that be or the powers that ought not be to have over people is staggering. And I don't think people realize that, or if they do, they shrug it off because of the convenience factor and the sense that having a phone gives them that they're connected to something real, which of course they're not.
Yes, exactly. I do a great deal of walking or running, and my wife and I, we go for hikes and in the woods and in the mountains around where we live. And I remember about a year or so ago, we were hiking on this isolated trail. There's no one on the trail, no one. And we finally, a couple came towards us. And not only did they have masks on, there was no one, absolutely no one in for miles. They had masks on, but you know, they had the cell phones out in their hands. And it was this gorgeous, gorgeous spot where the birds were singing, and it was in springtime, and the trees were, everything was blossoming, and it was really like a paradise. And here they come, like fearful and connected, as if being out of touch is, there's something wrong with it. But with the damn phone, you're never out of touch. You can't think your own thoughts. You can't listen to the birds. You can't appreciate the reality of the beautiful world we live in and our, you know, bodily connection to squirrels, to birds, to the sky and the stars. It's every, and there's a lake just up the hill from where we live. And we go walking there every day. And almost all the people we encounter have the phones up to their faces. They don't see you. They're zonked out. And this goes back to that great book, what is it, by Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451, is that it? I forget the title. in which he talks about people walking around with seashells in their ears, which is exactly what you see now, seashells, and they can't hear anyone. They can't, they're out of touch with reality, but they think they're in touch with reality. It's quite frightening, really.
Yes, it is. And we haven't even talked about what sort of radiation these devices give off, especially when we get into 5G or fifth generation, the EMFs. That's a lot of people like to poo-poo that, but that's a very real danger that I think is intentionally poo-pooed, because for, if no other reason, the powers that be want us to adopt this technology because of what it's going to allow them in terms of control. Now, to close, I want to point out some hopeful notes you hit on in this piece. One of those is actually the first two lines of this piece. Those who are never lost are forever lost. Only those who know they are lost and that life is a shipwreck have a chance to find their way to shore. And then, toward the end of your piece, just give me a moment here because I am scrolling. You write, "To plumb the depths of our sordid current world demands aesthetic, political, and spiritual resistance rooted in the open sociological imagination, a willingness to go wherever the facts and intuition leads us." And to bolster this, you have a quote from Rilke. And just above that, you have a quote from T.S. Eliot, another one of my favorite writers, from his poem, The Wasteland. "These fragments I have shored against my ruins." But what I really want to home in here on is, to get out of this, we first have to know that we're lost, and then from that knowledge, fortify ourselves with aesthetic, political, and spiritual resistance, as you put it. And an open sociological imagination, a willingness to go wherever the facts and intuition leads us, which is completely the opposite of what the propaganda blitz and the technology that enables that wants us to do.
Yes. You said it, Jesse. That's it. That's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And again, I would say that we could get up on a soapbox and preach about this, but who's going to listen? I think it's through setting our own individual examples, living by our principles, that we can hope people take notice and perhaps ask us, how come you don't have a cell phone, for example? And then that can lead into a conversation such as the one we have now. But at the same time, the rapidity with which we're heading into a life that is completely in silico is, I know there are people resisting this, but I question whether enough of us are. And look what that life based on in silico has been able to do, to create, in my opinion, based on my research, a non-existent virus that has led to unprecedented control of populations on a global scale. And this is just the beginning, what we've seen the past 2.5 years. I shudder to think what's to come. So we have about 30 seconds left. So any last words you'd like to leave us with? The floor is yours.
Well, I agree with you about personal example. I think that's very, very important. It's surely not enough. Your radio show goes out to many people, and so that is a shared conversation where people can think and engage in dialogue with themselves and with others. I know that, for example, I reviewed Robert Kennedy's book on Anthony Fauci, and then I tried to get many, many people to read it. I couldn't get anyone to read it except my wife, who was open-minded, and the book blew her away and changed her opinion on so many aspects of the whole COVID issue. So we can try, we encourage people, and you know, keep going. It's not hopeless. It's not hopeless. Ray McGovern just wrote a piece, and he said, you know, the American people, vis-a-vis the coming nuclear holocaust, are totally brainwashed. And they're totally brainwashed against Russia. And it's a very good article, and I would encourage people to read it. Raymond McGovern.
Ed Curtin, thank you very much.